May it please the court. My name is Patrick Lehler. My registration number is 33511, and I represent the appellant in this action, James Lynch. In my time before the court, I will argue that the trial court erred in failing to safeguard Mr. Lynch's due process rights during the course of his divorce. Specifically, I will argue that the trial court ignored his request under the Service Members Civil Relief Act for a continuance or a stay of the proceedings for 90 days. Second, that the trial court asserted jurisdiction over Mr. Lynch's military pension without a valid knowing and voluntary waiver by Mr. Lynch. And finally, that the trial court erred in ordering the production of otherwise privileged communications between Mr. Lynch and his former attorney. The facts of this case are straightforward. On August 10th, 2007, Ms. Albana, the appellee in this case, filed her petition for divorce. Mr. Lynch was not served with that petition. In fact, at the time, he was stationed in Afghanistan serving with the United States Army. Instead, a week later, on August 17th, an Illinois attorney, Thea Armstrong, signed a waiver of personal service for Mr. Lynch. There's nothing in the record to indicate that she was ever authorized to do so, and in fact, she never was.
Excuse me, counsel. Is there anything in the record that indicates that she was not authorized to do so? I didn't see anything in the record that said that.
And I believe you're correct, Your Honor. I don't think that issue was ever raised. However, to the court's point, and I'm sorry, Judge, did you have a question?
Please answer Judge Terry's question, and then I'll ask mine. Thank you.
Directly to that point, because Mr. Lynch was never served or never received any kind of notice to that, he wouldn't have even known about the representations made by Anna Bond, Ms. Albana's first attorney, that she did at the temporary orders hearing in November of 2007. What Ms. Bond represented to the court was that an attorney, Thea Armstrong, signed a waiver of personal service. In fact, in the transcript, the court clearly asked the question, why do we have jurisdiction over this case? And Ms. Bond makes two representations to the court. First, that Ms. Armstrong signed a waiver of personal service. What she does not tell the court, and I think this goes directly to your question, Judge Terry, is that, number one, Ms. Armstrong is in Illinois. Number two, she's not licensed to practice law in the state of Colorado. And number three, Mr. Lynch never authorized that. That never comes about.
Forgive me for interrupting, counsel, but what do we do with the transcript where counsel for your client says over and over and over and over again, we do not contest jurisdiction? Doesn't that make everything that you're discussing with regard to the Illinois attorney moot?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because, as noted in one of the points of error directly to Mr. Lynch's specific military retirement, under 10 U.S.C. 1048 Section C4, there is a higher standard than just simply granting jurisdiction. The fact that, and we don't contest, that if somebody makes a general appearance, then the court has personal jurisdiction over it, that is long-time established law. However, in terms of a specific personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction over Mr. Lynch's military retirement, that's a different issue and it requires a higher standard.
Well, if you've got jurisdiction over the person, don't you have jurisdiction over the pension?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor.
What's your authority for that? I'm sorry, I know we've skipped past your question, Judge, and I'm sorry.
Your Honor, in 1992, the Colorado Supreme Court, in the case of In Re the Marriage of Booker, specifically stated that Congress has authorized state courts to consider the status of military pension in a dissolution proceeding on the express condition that the court obtain personal jurisdiction over the military member in accordance with the specific statutory criteria of 1408 C4. What that section says is that military retirement income is a matter of federal, not state law. In order for a court to obtain jurisdiction over a military retirement, the member must affirmatively consent to the jurisdiction of the court.
Now, yes, but when counsel represents as an officer of the court, we do not contest jurisdiction. Why does that not satisfy that statute?
Two things, Your Honor. First of all, as the court correctly points out, Mr. Letterman makes these wild statements throughout that we're not contesting jurisdiction, but he does ever relates it to Mr. Lynch's military retirement. He never specifically
said. Why would he have to?
Because under
it's personal jurisdiction, right? And the pension jurisdiction keys off the personal jurisdiction. So if there's personal jurisdiction, there's pension jurisdiction, right?
Respectfully, I would disagree, Your Honor, and I would turn back to the language of In Re the Marriage of Booker. In that case, the Supreme Court said, although the trial court retained personal jurisdiction over the husband with respect to all other aspects of the dissolution decree, it did not, quote, retain jurisdiction to subsequently treat the husband's military pension as marital property of both parties. And that was in 1992. So it's established law under Colorado's jurisprudence that the court must affirmatively establish jurisdiction over the military member's pension. As we get back to the recitation of the facts, Your Honor, what that means is that because Mr. Lynch had no idea these proceedings were going on, then he had no way to know whether there was an issue of jurisdiction or not, because unless he ordered a transcript, he would have never seen that the court asked that question. Why do we have jurisdiction over it?
If I may, counsel.
Yes, sir.
He had a lawyer. The lawyer made, and I understand that you've characterized them as wild, but nonetheless, they're there. The lawyer made statements about this court has jurisdiction. They were broad statements. I understand you don't agree that that goes to the pension, and maybe so, maybe not so. It strikes me that they are pretty broad, and thus it strikes me that that is a clear statement of concession of jurisdiction for the entire case on all issues, but I appreciate your disagreement with that. But won't you at least concede that as far as personal jurisdiction over all other issues, as you just put it, that your client was properly before the court?
At this point, I believe that we would have to, Your Honor, simply because we filed appeals. When I entered my appearance, I went on to file other proceedings as a request to reconsider under Rule 60B. So I think the issue of Mr. Lynch's appearance and personal jurisdiction because of the subsequent issues, I believe we would have to concede that, Your Honor. During the November 5th, 2007 temporary orders hearing, the court asked, as I say, two questions. One was, why do we have jurisdiction? And Ms. Bond made the representation that Mr. Lynch had waived personal service, and we have this waiver from Ms. Armstrong. The court asked another question and made another comment. At that time, it asked about the Service Member Civil Relief Act, and in fact went so far as to comment that those attorneys down in Colorado Springs, they deal with this all the time. They would know the answer to this. Ms. Bond makes another representation to the court that in fact borders on misrepresentation. What she tells the court at that point is that we understand Mr. Lynch is going to proceed pro se. At that point, Ms. Bond has had no conversations with Mr. Lynch to make sure that that ever occurred. Secondly, if, assuming arguendo, Ms. Armstrong had the right to enter a waiver of service for Mr. Lynch, then you have an attorney entering a general appearance. Mr. Lynch couldn't have proceeded pro se because the other attorney would have had to file a request for withdrawal. That never occurred. What did occur is that on May 10th of 2008, Mr. Lynch filed a request for a 90-day stay pursuant to the Service Members Civil Relief Act. The court never ruled on that. Instead, what happened was a week later, the court conducted a telephone conference between counsel and then issued a minute order. And in that minute order, the court never addresses the SCRA. Instead, the court couches it in terms of discovery, saying that Mr. Lynch will produce certain documents and that the hearing will go forward on March 24th. Subsequent to that, the court held not one but two final orders hearing. There was motion practice, and indeed, this matter continued in litigation for almost a year later. That leads me to the first issue before the court, and that is that the trial court erred in ignoring Mr. Lynch's request for continuance pursuant to the Service Members Civil Relief Act.
Why isn't that moot at this point, counsel? a lot of water's gone under the dam since then, over the dam since then, under the bridge.
If I understand the court's question, specifically, it's not moot because the final orders hearings should have never happened. More importantly, what would have happened had they granted the request for continuance is that, one, Mr. Lynch would have been back in the country. Two, when Mr. Lynch was hit 2 days before the second final orders hearing with some 300 pages of discovery, he would have known what he was looking at. Ms. Albana's second attorney would have been able to present him with the specific documents. Instead, he was in Germany on a phone conference trying to conduct this.
Bennett, we're very aware that you're unhappy with Mr. Lederman's representation of your client, but wouldn't he have been required to renew his motion and say, we're not prepared to proceed because we're entitled to the stay? And by going ahead and proceeding with the hearing, didn't they waive the objection that you're now raising?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the court conducted the telephone conference and said, we're going forward at this point. So under that premise, the only issue would have been that the court would have had some obligation to make a ruling pursuant to the Service Members Civil Relief Act.
But our law is pretty clear that if you want a ruling on a motion, you need to ask the court for it and you need to renew the request. I understand you're unhappy with Mr. Lederman, but I'm trying to deal with the consequences of what happened here.
And you're absolutely right, Your Honor. However, this is not about Mr. Lederman and his representation, Mr. Lynch. The key is that federal law mandated that the court grant the stay on it. And in that case, specifically, 50 U.S.C. Section 521 provides that upon application of the member, the action shall be stayed unless the court determines that the member's ability to proceed or prosecute is not materially affected. Now, in this case, there are no findings of fact. There are no conclusions of law. There is nothing regarding his request under the SCRA. So the applicable law is not Colorado state law. It is federal law. And to that extent, the court erred in ignoring that request from Mr. Lynch. To that extent, that was a due process violation for Mr. Lynch because he filed the application. Everybody was on notice about it. In fact, the trial court had temporary orders asked about it.
Was this issue preserved in the trial court by your arguing to the trial court that it had made a due process violation by continuing with this proceeding?
I believe that it was overcome by events, Your Honor, that being that 1 week later, the court proceeded to final orders.
If in the absence of that argument being made to the trial court, aren't we supposed to, as the appeals court, find that that argument was waived by not being preserved?
I don't know, Your Honor. Finally and briefly, the trial court erred in ordering the production of otherwise privileged communication from Mr. Lynch. Those consisted of emails between Mr. Lynch and Mr. Lederman. Mr. Lynch was placed in an untenable position once the court issued its initial order of reserving how to award attorney's fees. The applicable law here, there are cases on waiver of attorney-client privilege. However, none of those cases per se relate directly since the 2005 Supreme Court decision in Alcon versus Spicer. In Alcon versus Spicer, which was a medical malpractice case, but since doctor-patient privilege is under the same statutory scheme as attorney-client privilege, in those cases, all of those, what the court said was, you can do a limited waiver without waiving your overall doctor-patient privilege. I would argue that this court should apply the same standard in terms of Mr. Lynch's partial waiver of attorney-client privilege because he was forced to defend himself.
Pardon me for interrupting, but do I understand correctly that Mr. Lynch is the first person who introduced emails between himself and his lawyer at the hearing? Those came from him first.
Yes, Your Honor.
So at this point, he is using those things as a sword. Then you're asking us to allow him to have a shield after he has already disclosed some of them to a third party, i.e. the court, who had no, it was not part of the relationship. Is that what you're asking us to do?
Your Honor, I see that my time is about to...
Please answer my question.
Answer your question.
Yes, sir, please do.
Conclude. I believe that the premise of the court is incorrect in that he was not using them as a sword. Mr. Lynch, as I say, was placed because, as we get back to the issue of needing a stay, Mr. Lynch was forced to defend himself against his own attorney's actions to avoid being further sanctioned for attorney's fees. So in that respect, what he showed at the initial attorney's fees order or hearing was specific emails that showed that he had no knowledge of any kind of motion to compel. In fact, Mr. Letterman didn't even inform him of it until well after the time for responding was due, and in fact told him, don't worry about it. So to that extent, the only reason those were submitted were simply as a shield to say, it wasn't me directly dragging my feet on this. In conclusion, Your Honors, what Mr. Lynch is asking the court to do is to remand this case. He respectfully prays that based upon the fact that the court ignored jurisdictional issues in this, he asks this court remand or reverse and remand the case for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Lehler.
May it please the court, my name is Ann Gill. My registration number is 14610. I'm here today on behalf of Albina Alla, the wife in this dissolution case. I'd like to attempt to answer the questions that you posed to husband's counsel. I believe that the trial court properly exercised jurisdiction in this case. Civil Rule of Procedure 4H, subsection 5, addresses waiver of service and allows for a waiver of service to be filed either by a party or by an attorney. It does not require that the attorney be a Colorado attorney. However, even if you want to get involved in the issue whether an Illinois attorney could properly waive service, I believe that the subsequent unlimited general appearance by counsel in November of 07 waived any problem with service. There were further indicia of a general appearance at the first permanent orders hearing in March when counsel on the record stated repeatedly that they conceded jurisdiction in this case. To follow up on Judge Terry's questions about whether this affected a jurisdiction over military retired pay, as opposing counsel correctly pointed out, jurisdiction over military retired pay is controlled by federal statute 10 U.S.C. 1408, which premises jurisdiction on one of three bases: domicile, residence, or consent to jurisdiction. Although that might appear to be identical to state law on personal jurisdiction, the case Marriage of Booker does take that a step further. I think that the language in Booker is such that it would cover this situation. It says that the purpose of the act is not whether the military member simply waived his right to contest personal jurisdiction. The statutory language requires some form of affirmative conduct demonstrating express or implied consent to general in personam jurisdiction. That's on page 740 in the Booker case. Here I think that there was express consent to general personal jurisdiction by counsel's statement of conceding jurisdiction. It was further conceded in his trial management order, in which he said that military retired pay was part of the marital estate and was the subject to division in this dissolution process.
Do you have a record cite for that, counsel, for the trial management order? I'll find it.
I'm sorry, I have it in my notes.
I'll find it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Husband also affirmed explicitly requested relief in the dissolution action, not only over the military retired pay, but he requested maintenance in the dissolution action. So he clearly was asking for affirmative relief in the district court. And I think that covers jurisdiction both over the balance of the marital estate and the military retired pay. The issue of the Service Member Civil Relief Act and the request for a stay under that is interesting because although the language of the act does say that a stay is mandatory, it also requires a service member to take two affirmative steps to invoke the act, and neither of those steps were taken in this case. Those are that the service member must affirmatively state that he is on duty that prevents him from appearing at the at the scheduled hearing, and second, that there must be a letter or some writing from his commanding officer that basically affirms that the military member is unavailable to be in court on the date.
Where would I find those requirements, counsel, that you just mentioned?
That is in 50 Act USC Section 520 and 521. Maybe 522. I believe I quoted those in my answer brief, Your Honor. However, the parties in December of 07 entered a stipulation motion to continue the first setting for permanent orders, which had been set on January 28. The reason they stipulated to continue that hearing was because Mr. Lynch was unavailable due to his active duty status. The court conducted a status conference by phone on January 28, 08, at which time the court set the matter for the permanent orders hearing in March 08, based on the understanding that Mr. Lynch would be available at that time.
What are we to do with the fact that the trial court did not rule on the motion that was made under the statute?
I think that it is an implied denial of the motion, and because Wife did respond to the motion, pointing out the deficiencies in compliance with the requirements under the federal statute for obtaining a stay, that there was an implied denial of the stay for failure to comply with the act. The final point that opposing counsel has raised before you about the attorney-client privilege and the emails, I believe that Judge Bernard is on track that Mr. Lynch affirmatively produced some of those emails at the attorney's fees hearing, in which there was contention about whether it was Mr. Lynch who should be liable for attorney's fees for needlessly expanding or delaying proceedings and his failure to comply with the mandatory disclosures in this case. And he presented the emails to indicate that he had followed the advice of counsel. I believe he opened the door then to the court requiring him to produce all of the emails in which he had his colloquy with his counsel about the complying with the mandatory financial disclosures. I think it is significant to note that in the court's first attorney's fees order, which was a Lexis filed on April 20th, 09, signed by the judge on April 17th, one of the first things that the court does is to quote from an October 07 email from Mr. Lynch to a lawyer whom he apparently had contacted in preparation for responding, in which Mr. Lynch states in this email that he would not comply with mandatory disclosures, that he would not do the work that the opposing counsel ought to be doing. So it shows that Mr. Lynch was actively involved in resistance to complying with mandatory disclosures, which supports the court's final determination on attorney's fees that to the extent that they were awarded on the basis as a sanction, either for discovery violations or under 1317.102 for needlessly expanding the procedures, both Mr. Lynch and his then attorney were actively involved in resisting the mandatory disclosures and in not complying, such that there was the first permanent orders hearing in March based on the limited disclosures that had been provided to them. The next day, Wife got financial statements from the various banks where there were accounts and discovered significant discrepancies between those bank statements and the ones that had been produced in discovery after her motions to compel and the interrogatories. And that caused there to be a second permanent orders hearing, which the court determined that there had been dissipation and found that $37,000 had been dissipated based on the evidence in those financial statements which wife obtained directly from the banks. So I think that the court was appropriately investigating who was liable, and it did split the attorney's fees award evenly between Mr. Lynch and his counsel who had engaged in these conducts. As you've pointed out at the beginning of this argument, Your Honor, significant issues in this appeal were not preserved on the record by being raised in the district court, yet they were argued strenuously in the briefs in this case. The opening brief did not state where issues had been preserved in the trial court, I think because several of those issues had not been preserved. That is the basis of the wife's request for an award of attorney's fees under 1317.102. She also requests an award of attorney's fees on this appeal under 1410.119 based on the incredible disparity of the financial situation of the parties. The last information in the record is dated. I think it's almost 2 years old now. If this court does grant wife's request and remand for attorney's fees, wife will happily update her financial information so that could be considered under 1410.119. I ask that you affirm the trial court's ruling in this matter and remand for an award of attorney's fees for the appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gill. This concludes the argument on this case. Thank you, counsel, very much for your helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in